This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents We're Going to Need More Wine, Stories That Are Funny, Complicated, and True by Gabrielle Union. This is the author. Introduction. This kind of feels like a first date. I have that same feeling you get 5 minutes before you meet the other person when you're giddy about where things might go, but also wary because you've been on enough bad dates to know exactly how this can go awry. They order the salmon and pronounce the L, and you're like, how the hell has my life come to this? No pressure, but I have thought of you the whole time I've been writing this book. I have never shared these stories outside of a close circle of people, the friends you can tell all your secrets to because you know all of theirs. So I want this to be like one of those nights out with someone you can be real with. We're sitting across from each other over drinks, and we're in the middle of this ridiculous, hyperventilating laugh cry because even I can't believe I did some of these things, foolishness, that made perfect sense at the time but sounds ludicrous now. Oh, no, it gets worse, I say, taking a sip as everyone in the restaurant looks over at us losing it. These are the stories that require reinforcements. If I'm going to really get into them, we need to flag the waiter and tell him not to be a stranger and to keep pouring, because we're going to need more wine tonight. Thinking of you this past year, I jotted down notes, sent texts to myself, and went back to look at some of the books that meant something to me and left me better for reading them. One of the things I marked to share was a line from James Baldwin. The very time I thought I was lost, my dungeon shook and my chains fell off. Baldwin was quoting a spiritual about the strength that comes from survival. I have felt lost plenty. Stuck in the dungeons I was thrown into, and some I even locked myself into. I felt the chains of growing up trying to be someone I wasn't, and then living in Hollywood, a town that rewards pretending. The dungeon represents so many parts of my life and all of our lives. I don't think I'm special or that my pain makes me unique. I've had a couple moments, okay, months, maybe years, where the idea of disappearing and never being seen again seemed like an appealing option. I've been lucky that someone was always there to give me hope, whether it was a member of my support group at UCLA's Rape Crisis Center or my dog Bubba crawling under my bed to find me hiding from life after public humiliation. They rescued me from my dungeons, and later, I had to do the work to shake off the shackles that I had put on myself. I hemmed myself in with shame, and also with the fear of not being chosen by men. I remember the moment I realized I was free. Looking in a mirror and saying, I choose my motherfucking self! We'll get to that. Right now, I should just tell you at the outset that I have trust issues. I have to wonder if I will pay a consequence for telling my truth. We're entering a full-on relationship where I have all this hope that my words are going to be interpreted the way I intend. I don't want you to have to guess about my intentions. I want to make you laugh, cry as we tackle some big stuff. And if you don't agree with me, I want you to be able to say, at least that bitch is honest. Oh, yeah, you should know that I cuss. You never knew that, did you? Having a publicist has served me well. Let's press on. Nothing to see here. It was terrifying putting myself back into some of the scenes you'll find here. But it was also the essential work of finding my authentic self. As I retraced the steps and missteps of my life, I began to stop avoiding memories that triggered emotional flashbacks, and I chose to embrace them as revelations. Each revealed a breadcrumb that I had dropped along the way, leading me further on my path to understanding who I truly am. Reading all these stories together, I wondered if I really was brave enough to share all of this. And then I remembered another quote I wrote down. This one comes from Carrie Fisher. Stay afraid, but do it anyway. So cheers. Here's to us being afraid and doing it anyway. Chapter 1. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Pleasanton.
It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk. When I was in the second grade, my parents moved us from Omaha, Nebraska, to Pleasanton, California. My parents had spent a year living in San Francisco just after they got married, and my arts-loving mother had lived for the city's culture and open spirit. So when my father announced he was getting transferred to go back to the Bay Area, she rejoiced. My mother pushed for Oakland, where we would be around other black families and still close to all that San Francisco had to offer. But my father, obsessed with keeping up with the Joneses, had bigger plans. He had a white work friend who had moved to Pleasanton, a half-hour drive and a world away from Oakland. If it's good enough for Dave, he said, it's good enough for us. In Omaha, we were part of the largest African-American extended family in Nebraska. In Pleasanton, we would be the chocolate chip in the cookie. My mother didn't want that for her daughters, me, my older sister Kelly, and my younger sister Tracy. Well, she lost that battle. Everything she feared came to pass. The residents of Pleasanton divided themselves into housing developments, and where you lived said everything about who you were. We bought a house in Val Vista, which was working middle class with upper middle class goals. Val Vista was considered just below Valley Trails in the Pleasanton development caste system. But neither of those neighborhoods was nearly as good as the Meadows, across town, where they had green belts that connected all the cul-de-sacs in the streets. When you told someone where you lived, it was shorthand for the truth of your family's economic situation. Good, average, or untouchable. Since birth, my family has called me Nikki, from my middle name Monique. It took a little less than a year, in Pleasanton, for someone to call me nigger. It was during third grade recess at Fairlands Elementary, and it came from Lucas. He was one of the Latino kids bussed in from Komodorsky, the low-income housing development. He rode with Carmen, Lori, and Gabriel, or as everyone called them, the Komodorsky kids. One day, Lucas decided my name made for great racist alliteration. "Nikki's a nigger," he said, pointing at me with a huge smile of revelation, like he'd found me in a game of hide-and-seek. For one day to my face, and who knows how many days behind my back, Nigger Nikki caught on like wildfire. The kids chanted it, trying on the word as a threat. Nigger. And a question. Nigger? And then a sing-song. Nigger Nikki, Nigger Nikki. I couldn't afford to stand out like that ever again. So I became obsessed with observing the Komodorsky kids, clocking all the shit they did that everyone, meaning the white ones, made fun of. I wanted to be the exact opposite. And I was clocking the white kids too, of course. I looked at them and thought, that's where I'm going to. And when I saw the Komodorsky kids, all I could think was, that's where I'm running from. With every single move I made and every word I spoke, I stayed hyper-alert to what I called the black pitfalls. What were the things that would make me appear blacker? I only ate chicken with a knife and fork, and never in front of white people. Certainly not KFC. And no fruit on a rind. You were not going to see a toothy grin and watermelon scene from me. I had been warned, of course. My parents gave me the pep talk when I started school, the same speech all black parents give their kids. You're going to have to be bigger, badder, better, just to be considered equal. You're going to have to do twice as much work, and you're not going to get any credit for your accomplishments or for overcoming adversity. Most black people grow accustomed to the fact that we have to excel just to be seen as existing. And this is a lesson passed down from generation to generation. You can either be super Negro or the forgotten Negro. It's actually very accurate advice, but the problem with putting it on a kid is that if you're not as good as or eight times as good as, you feel like you're less than. Not just in academics or in sports,
Every kid cares about something and wants to receive love and praise for that particular quality or ability. You're always chasing, always worrying about being exposed as the dumb black kid, the foolish nigger. On one hand, it puts your shoulder to the wheel, so you're always pushing, working, striving. But one misstep, and it's over. An A-minus can feel like Hiroshima. It's catastrophic because you feel exposed. It's still an A, but what it feels like is dumb nigger. You're a joke. Of course you missed it, nigger. I had that fear as a kid with every worksheet. Do you remember the time tests with multiplication? I became psychotic about those. I would see 4 times 16 equals blank and hear my father's voice, bigger, badder, better. By the way, it's taking everything I have not to tell you I know the answer is 64, which leads me to 64 being a perfect square, which leads me down the rabbit hole of listing other perfect squares, and who cares? I did. This insane need to stay beyond reproach by being perfect also applied to getting a bathroom pass. Other kids would ask the teacher for one, and she would say, "You've got 5 minutes," tapping her watch. She never gave me a time because I was the fastest piss in the West. I always timed myself, literally counting each second, because I wanted to come back with so much time left on the 5-minute mental clock that she didn't even need to give me a deadline. The following year, Tarsha LaBird showed up on the bus from Komodorsky. Her family had moved there from Oakland. She was black, described by everyone as so black, and she had these corduroys she wore all the time. Tarsha had a big grown-up ass as a third grader, and the top of her butt would always be bursting out of those cords. I didn't tell my mother there was another black girl at school, but she heard about it. "You better be nice to her," she said, "because they're all going to be mean to her." Because Tarsha had become a walking, lumbering punchline of people pointing at her crack, I convinced myself that if I just ignored her, I would be doing right by her. I wouldn't join in on making fun of her. She was simply invisible to me. At lunchtime, the girls at my table called a meeting. One girl looked right at me. "Are you going to be friends with Tarsha LaBird?" Tarsha was sitting close by, so I quietly said, "No." But I made a face showing that the very idea was preposterous. Why would I have anything to do with that girl? Another girl stared at me and said, loud enough for Tarsha to hear, "If you don't like Tarsha LaBird, raise your hand." And everyone put up 2 hands and looked at me. I heard my mother's voice and felt Tarsha's eyes on me. I raised my hand just to my shoulder, a half-hearted vote against her. "Well, I don't know her," I said. I waved my hand side to side by my shoulder, hoping it would read as waffling to Tarsha and, above it all, to the table. A day went by. I was in my gifted and talented education program doing calligraphy, thank you very much, when a voice came over the intercom. "Please send Nikki to the principal's office." I naturally thought I was getting an award. My smug self just paused, elegantly finished my line of calligraphy, and packed my books. I waltzed to the principal's office, practicing a look of, "Who, me?" gratitude. Principal McKinley, a burly Irish man with kind eyes, peered at me, taking my measure. "Nikki, did you raise your hand when asked if you don't like Tarsha LaBird?" "No," I said. "I did this." I showed my discreet half-wave because I started to cry. Ball. In my head, I was already 4 steps ahead, my mom disappointed in me for being mean to the other black girl. Principal McKinley told me he was putting my name in the blue book, which was, to my third grade understanding, an unholy text containing the names of bad children. Teacher said it could follow you and you might not get into the college of your choice. The principal then told me that if I behaved for the rest of the year, he would have my name erased from it. But I didn't believe him. Even years later, when I was applying to colleges, there was a small part of me that wondered, is my name still in the blue book? I was the only person to get in trouble for this conversation, and it had to have come from Tarsha. I wasn't mad at her. I was very aware that I had done the wrong thing, but I also knew why I'd done it. It was survival of the fittest, Lord of the Flies in suburbia, and I had to eat. Tarsha remained invisible to me through elementary school. At the time, I told myself she was invisible because she just didn't have much of a personality. I know now I was only justifying my refusal to connect with her. I was afraid to take the risk of being black by standing next to her. From second grade to sixth grade, Jody Manning and I were neck and neck when it came to grade point average. Her family lived in the Meadows, one of the richest neighborhoods in Pleasanton, and they just had nice stuff. Their house, in my mind, felt like a museum. It felt rich. When I was little, one of my barometers for wealth was if the family had Welch's grape juice. I noticed that all the rich kids drank it after school. The Mannings definitely had Welch's. The Unions had grape drink. After school and at recess, we started playing Days of Our Lives. Everyone chose a character, and we just invented scenarios. Jody Manning was Marlena, Scott Jenkins was Roman Brady, and my friend Katie was Hope. I'd like to tell you that this is where I discovered a love of acting. No. Maybe because I always had to be Abe the policeman, he was the only black guy on Days, Black Lexi didn't come on for a couple more years. So, I was Abe the policeman. As if it weren't enough that she also got to play Marlena, Jody and her sister also always had coordinating full Esprit outfits. And it wasn't from the Esprit outlets where you got, like, the sweatshirt and paired it with Garanimal's trash. They were just perfect, those Mannings. And Jody set a high bar for competition in class. I remember we once did a presentation together in the sixth grade. The job was to come up with an ad campaign for a product, and we were assigned Bumblebee Tuna. I was the talent, thank you. Our catchphrase was just saying, Bumblebee Tuna, emphatically. Everyone was saying it at recess, so we got an A+. In case you're not already reaching for the Nerd Alert button, around this time, I started reading 3 newspapers a day. And that became an obsession, like times tables and square roots. I would figure out exactly, down to the minute, how long I could be in the shower, how long it would take me to get ready, and still have time to read the newspapers. The first two, the Tri-Valley Herald and the Valley Times, were exactly how they sound. Here's an actual headline in the Valley Times, which I cut out and laminated for my civics class. Mexicans rob the mall. Meanwhile, the Mexicans were from, like, the next town over, and they probably knocked over a sunglass hut. So those papers didn't take me that long. But then I would read the Oakland Tribune, which was much more involved. On the rare occasion that I didn't finish, I would take whatever was left, and I would go through it in my first period class, usually an English class. If I didn't, I just couldn't focus. I honestly don't know what came first, a love of reading the newspapers or wanting to be super Negro, the magical special black person who has all the knowledge and is never caught out there looking ignorant. She is so knowledgeable, is what I lived for. That black girl is really something. My other job was to be popular, which I approached with the same strategy as my studies, meaning it was everything. Sleepovers were the thing among the girls, and you had to be there or else you would be discussed. I had all the sleepover worries preteens have about pranks and fears that I would smell by morning. But my hair was also a problem. I didn't want to go through the normal ritual that I did at home, wrapping my hair with a scarf, because it would draw attention to my blackness and therefore my difference. When in Rome, do as the white girls do. So I would put my hair in a ponytail or a bun and try to keep as still as possible all night. As we call it, sleeping pretty. But eventually slumber takes over and you become a human being. By the time I woke up in the morning, my hair would be unruly. Oh my God, you look like buckwheat, someone would invariably say, pointing to the mass of hair on my head. Eddie Murphy's SNL version of buckwheat was still fresh and popular, all hair and teeth, and, oh, hey, do buckwheat. And I would do it. I would go into the buckwheat got shot routine with my hand in the air like Eddie's. Every time I said, oh, hey, the girls would die. Now that I was willingly their clown, the directives began. Act like you put your finger in a socket. Pretend you're a Cupid doll. I pulled my hair up to make it stand on end. Making them laugh gave me the illusion of agency and control. Minstrelsy makes the audience comfortable. Now that I'm on the other side of it and proud of my blackness, They wouldn't know what to do with me. People don't know what to do with you if you are not trying to assimilate. Nevertheless, I did manage to create real, lasting friendships with other girls during this period. And we liked to have fun. We had our first kegger in the 7th grade, right before school let out for summer. We were farting around in a park, and we saw these older kids hide their pony cake in the bushes. We waited for them to leave, snuck over, got their pony cake, and rolled it right on over to my friend Missy Baldwin's house. None of us knew how to open it, so we hammered a screwdriver into the side until we made a hole and were able to drain the beer into a bucket. And then we had all this beer. So we called people, meaning boys, and they biked over to Missy's house. There was just this trove of Huffies and BMXs dropped in her front yard as kids raced to the back, practically shouting, "Beer!" The house got trashed and kids put her lawn furniture in her pool. This wasn't even at night, and it was in a planned community, but her parents were hippies and were like, "Missy, man, that's not cool." That wouldn't have worked with my parents, but they had no idea where I was anyway. They put in long days at their telecommunications jobs. My dad in San Jose, my mom in Oakland, both a one-hour commute away. My older sister Kelly, who acted as if she had birthed herself, was given a very long leash, but she had a lot of responsibility too. If anything happened, my sister had to take care of it. If I had a dentist appointment, she would have to take time off from school activities to play chauffeur. Class projects, homework, she was my Google before there was Google. In high school, she loved sports, but didn't have my natural athleticism. She quickly recognized the gifts she had and segued into being a team manager and coaching youth basketball. Everything she wore was from Lerner, and she became a manager there at 16. There she was in her blazers with the huge shoulder pads. I idolized her, but also took her guidance and intelligence for granted. She and Tracy, my little sister, had the caregiver-child relationship because of the 11 years between them. I was in the middle, completely under my family's radar. So, I created a family of my friends. They were everything to me, and as a result, I was hardly ever home. I only drank with friends, enjoying the game of getting the alcohol as much as drinking it. We'd steal from our parents or con older relatives into buying it for us. We used to play a drinking game called Vegetable. Each person would choose a vegetable and try to say it without showing our teeth. And then we'd give someone another vegetable to say. You'd always pick something tough, like rhubarb or asparagus or russet potatoes. If you showed your teeth by laughing, for instance, you had to pound a Keystone Light or whatever contraband we'd gotten our hands on that evening. And it doesn't take a lot to laugh when you're drunk on cheap beer and high, which oftentimes we were. But there were little matters of etiquette in these situations that reminded me of my place. When you shared a can of beer, the directive was always, "Don't nigger lip it." It meant, "Don't get your mouth all over it." Another common term was nigger rig. To nigger rig something was to MacGyver it or fix it in a half-ass way, to wit, opening a pony keg with a screwdriver. Sometimes people would catch themselves saying nigger in front of me. "Oh, there's niggers and there's, you know, cool black people," they'd say to excuse it. "You're not like them." In my English class in 9th grade, we read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn aloud. The teacher made us take alternating paragraphs in order of where we sat in class. We were seated alphabetically by name, so as a U, I was in the back of the class. Twain uses the word nigger exactly 219 times in the book. I would count the paragraphs to read ahead and see if there were any niggers in what I had to say. Each time a kid said nigger, the whole class turned their heads to watch my response. Some turned to look at me just before they read it aloud, wincing in an apology that only made me more aware of the blackness I was trying so hard to escape. Others turned to smile as they said it, aiming nigger right at me. But most times it felt like kids at my school simply forgot I was black. Perversely, I was relieved when they did. I had so completely stopped being black to these people that they could speak to me as a fellow white person. Nigger wasn't the only slur slung around at the few people of color who dotted the overwhelmingly white student population. But being so focused on my own situation, I wasn't always proficient in racist slang. Sure, I could decipher jokes about the Latino kids and the couple of Asian girls, but it took me a long time to realize people weren't calling our classmate Mahal a kite. In Pleasanton, you were either Catholic or Mormon, and Mahal was proudly Jewish. She invited us all to her bat mitzvah. Nobody went. Our belief system was, Jews kill Jesus, Jews are bad. Mahal flew the flag, and so she was out. But when we found out Eric Wademaker was Jewish, it was like he'd had a mask ripped off at the end of Scooby-Doo. You know Wadi's a Jew? What? But he's so cool. The pressure to assimilate infused every choice we made, no matter our race. Kids who didn't use the slurs certainly didn't speak up against classmates or parents using them. They adopted the language, or they kept silent. Because to point out inequality in the town would mean Pleasanton was not perfect. And Pleasanton had to be perfect. When I was 13, my parents began sending me back to Omaha alone to spend summers with my mother's mother. It was at my request. My older sister was going off to college, and I was looking for more freedom. As soon as the plane landed, I heard a sound like the sprinklers of California when they started up, that sharp zzz, zzz, but at a constant hum. It was the sound of insects. Cicadas provided the backdrop to my Omaha summers. My grandmother brought my cousin Kenyatta to the airport to meet me that first year. A year younger than me, she was effortlessly cool. My grandmother raised Kenyatta while her mother, Aunt Carla, was in and out of jail. Grandma also raised Kenyatta's little brother. Aunt Carla was never out for more than a year and a half. She was awesome, don't get me wrong. She just had a problem with drugs. Kenyatta was very thin, like me, with really big eyes and chocolate brown skin. Her lips literally looked like four bubbles briefly joining on the edge of bursting. Those lips, boys always said in admiration, making kissing faces at her. Kenyatta gave me access to the cool black kids in the neighborhood. She had all these tough friends, some of whom had already been to juvie. They were all pretty and all having sex. She had told her friends her cousin from California was coming, so a bunch of them waited outside of Grandma's house to meet me. To them, California was three things: beaches, celebrities, and gangs. They came ready to talk to me about what I had seen of the Crips and the Bloods. "Hi there," I said, getting out of the car. Their faces sank. It was over. "Oh, Jesus," her friend Essence said. "Your cousin is white, Kenyatta." "You're an Oreo," said this boy, Sean. It wasn't a surprise, but it wasn't something to get upset about. I had hoped to get off the plane and slip into a new life. Be a Janet Jackson doing Charlene on Different Strokes, or my greatest wish, Lisa Bonet on The Cosby Show. The cool black girl that Pleasanton could never appreciate. But I was still just me. Luckily, I was under Kenyatta's protection. They could tease me, but only so much. "Did you bring the tapes?" she asked. "Yeah," I said, opening my carry-on to pull out two cassettes. She had asked me to tape California radio stations so her crew could press play and be transported to the beaches with the celebrities and the gangbangers. We all went upstairs and crowded into her room, which would now also become my room. My grandmother had crammed two twin beds in there, so we all sat down. Kenyatta couldn't get that tape in her boombox fast enough. Everyone leaned in as she pressed play. Crowded houses, "Don't Dream It's Over," filled the room. "What the fuck is this?" asked Sean. "It's the radio back home," I said. "This is what they play in California." "Do they play L.A. Dream Team?" asked Kenyatta. "World-class wrecking crew?" I pretended to know who they were, then remembered the radio station's tagline. I said, "They play the hits." I taped 120 minutes of the top 40 of Pleasanton. At first, they gave it a chance. Heart, Whitesnake, they gave up at Tiffany. Kenyatta put in a new edition tape, and my heart leapt. I was obsessed with them, the few black boys who showed up on MTV. We girls bonded right there, talking about Bobby Brown leaving the group and Johnny Gill coming in, and which one of us Ralph Tresvant would pick out in a crowd. I could hold my own talking about New Edition, but I felt real green on being black. And everyone was black in my grandmother's North Omaha neighborhood. Beyond New Edition, I wasn't up on anything when it came to being black. My grandma lived on the edge of what was considered a bad area, and it was its own world without white people. The way people talked about white folks when there are no white folks around was dramatically different, just as white folks spoke differently about black people when they thought black people weren't around, except in Pleasanton, where they forgot I was black because I blended in so well. I began studying my cousin Kenyatta and her friends to relearn blackness. Otherwise, I would be dismissed as corny, which was the death kiss in Omaha. To be corny there was the equivalent of being labeled a nerd in Pleasanton. You couldn't come back from it. No boy would even consider coming near you. Being off limits and forever friend zone was a given as the black girl in Pleasanton. But in Omaha, I had a shot at getting boys to like me the way I like them. I couldn't blow it. I earned respect pretty quickly, and I'm sure a lot of that had to do with being Kenyatta's cousin. Mostly I did it by keeping a poker face and not saying anything, no matter how surprised or confused I was by something people did or said. Nobody tried to mess with me. I liked North Omaha from the jump. The dampness in the air and how the sun never really shone. Somehow, though, the few white folks we saw on trips to the mall were all kind of tanned in this ruddy color that white people turn when they're overheated. Everyone just lived out on their blocks, hanging back, chilling, talking shit, flirting. Every so often, the sky would suddenly turn black and everyone would start running because there was a tornado coming. As soon as it blew by, everyone came back outside to the streets. It was Midwest summer when there's nothing to do. We were kids with no jobs, so every morning the conversation went like this. Where are we going to go today? What boy's house can we walk to? Whose parents aren't home? Who has a car? Just finding somebody with a car was incredibly rare. In Pleasanton, everybody had a car. But in Omaha, people got around through what they called jitneys. Elderly people that you knew your whole life would say, hey, call me if you need to get to the store. Just give me $3. Teenagers even drank differently in North Omaha. It wasn't the binge drinking of mixed drinks in plastic cups like in Pleasanton. If you were kicking back on the stoop, you had a 40 or a wine cooler. The penny candy store was right next to the liquor store. So when we hung out in front of the candy store, folks might have thought we were there to get candy, but we were really waiting on a mark. When you found one, you would shoulder tap the guy. Hey, can you get me a 40 of Mickey's Big Mouth? Mickey's Big Mouth is a malt liquor also known as a grenade for the shape of the bottle it comes in. It was never tough. It was a very exciting time in my life, and there was a bit of danger that felt glamorous. The summer I was 13, crack started to show up in North Omaha. My Aunt Carla also got out of jail. I saw her as effortlessly cool and admired her gift for always having guys around. She was staying with a boyfriend, even though she always had a home at my grandmother's if she needed it. The guys who she introduced me to were always really nice, and only later would you find out that so-and-so was involved in one of the largest drug busts in the history of the Midwest. Aunt Carla came over to Grandma's soon after she was sprung and saw a letter from my parents. They were sending me $80 cash a week that summer to give to my grandmother. Selfish me kept that cash, of course. Let me hold that $80, Aunt Carla said, and on Friday, I'll give you $300 and we'll go to Red Lobster. Sure, I said, handing her the money. It was Monday, and I knew I'd have another $80 the next week, so it wasn't a big deal. Wednesday, my aunt came over again. Give me your sizes, she said. I want to get you some back-to-school clothes. I want guest jeans, I said, and then reeled off my sizes along with a list of additional asks. Lo and behold, Friday came and Aunt Carla showed up in a limo, carrying shopping bags full of clothes for Kenyatta and me. Now let's go to Red Lobster, she said, handing me my $300. It was my first time in a limo. Kenyatta and I opened the windows and waved to everyone we passed on the ride to dinner. At the restaurant, we feasted, ordering the lobster and shrimp combo and eating every Cheddar Bay biscuit in sight. When we emerged rubbing our stomachs, the limo was gone. I only had it for the way over, Aunt Carla said, slotting a coin in the nearby payphone as she took a drag on a cigarette. Her friend eventually showed up in a Buick. And as we started the drive home, she said, "I need to stop at Kmart. Stay in the car," she told us. She went inside to write a few bad checks while we waited. "You girls doing good?" said the driver. We both nodded. He proceeded to pull out a crack pipe and smoke up. The windows were closed, so we couldn't help but be hotboxed. We didn't feel any secondhand effects, but I would always immediately recognize that smell as an adult traveling the country and going to clubs. We were familiar with crack already because our friends were dealers. We'd seen plenty of crack pipes and even watched people weigh it for parceling. North Omaha was rapidly changing, and every summer, the changes escalated. The LA-based dealers had begun to spread out across the country to get a piece of the local drug trade everywhere. Gang members came to North Omaha, selling a lifestyle as if they were setting up franchises. But it was also bizarre to watch. North Omaha is made up of a bunch of families that have been there for generations. You walk down the street and somebody can identify what family you belong to by your facial features. All of a sudden, here come these powerful gangs splitting up families as kids randomly chose different gang sets. A lot of my cousins and neighborhood kids that I'd grown up with during my summer visits, boys and girls, began to claim allegiance to LA gangs that they didn't know anything about. It started as a saccharine, almost Disney-like version of gang life. When I returned at 14, every young person was touched by some sort of criminal enterprise with varying degrees of success. Some kids got one rock of cocaine and announced, "I'm a drug dealer." Then there were kids who, as teenagers, were doing, in terms of drug dealing, very well for themselves. They had their own apartments and flaunted their wealth. At the end of the day, I didn't look at crack so negatively because I saw our little friends making money off it. Drug dealing felt like any other job to me. I only knew young dealers and the random ones that my aunt knew. I didn't see the underbelly, the violence, the desperation, the addiction. All I knew was I gave my aunt $80 and she gave me $300 back. That was integrity. I later found out that Aunt Carla asked her friend, who was a booster, a shoplifter by profession, thank you, to get those school clothes for me at the mall. I didn't think less of her or those clothes. I thought Aunt Carla was smart, and I went to Red Lobster in a limo. If someone smoked crack on the way home, that was a small price to pay for the adventure. A footnote, really. What remains is that she kept her word. In retrospect, I guess it's naive to think this would all end well, but I saw honor among thieves. In the midst of this, I was still Nikki, trying to get boys to like me, specifically Kevin Marshall. The summer I was 14, Kenyatta and I invited two boys over to my grandmother's with the promise of alcohol, Andy Easterbrook and beautiful Kevin. I was truly, madly, deeply, over the moon in love with Kevin. He was caramel-colored with green eyes and a great athlete. He wasn't supposed to like a chocolate girl like me, and he liked me. First order of business, coming through on that promised alcohol. Kenyatta and I decided to steal my Aunt Joanne's wine coolers. This was the biggest mistake of the summer. God, if there was anybody who counted their wine coolers, it was Aunt Joanne. But when you're a kid and you see 2 4-packs and there are boys to impress, you take one or two and say, "There's still some left." Boy, did we pay for that. Next, we had to sneak Andy and Kevin into the house without Grandma knowing. Now, Grandma was always in her rocking chair, and she had to get out of it in order to see the door. So we knew that we would have a fighting chance to sneak the boys up the stairs while Grandma was working up enough momentum to propel her ass out of the chair. Even better, we knew she couldn't go upstairs because of her knees. But as the wine cooler situation makes clear, Kenyatta and I were dumb as fuck. We ran in, pushing the boys in front of us and yelling, "Hi, Grandma! Bye, Grandma!" as we raced up the stairs. My grandma was slow and her knees were shit, but she wasn't deaf. She kept yelling, "Who all is in here?" Because you can surely tell the difference between 2 sets of feet and 4 heading up the stairs, especially boys racing to get alcohol. So, Grandma simply refused to go to sleep. She got up from her chair and she sat on the couch next to the front door. She knew whoever we'd snuck in eventually had to come down because there was no bathroom upstairs. Somebody's gotta pee. Someone's gotta leave. And she was gonna be there to see it. Of course, she knew we were smoking weed up there. We were making this big attempt to hide it, blowing the smoke through the window screens, but you couldn't open the screens, and the mesh was so small that the smoke just stayed in the room. So our play to hide our business didn't work at all. Between the wine coolers and the Mickey's Big Mouth they had gallantly brought, the boys had to pee soon enough. They filled the empty bottles, but then had to go again. So then they had the bright idea to pour the bottled pee out through the screen. All that weed smoke not making it through the tiny mess should have shown us that this was not a good idea. Between kid logic and the weed, it made perfect sense at the time. The piss just pooled in the gutter of the window. Hot urine in the windowsill. Ah, the romance and brilliance of the teenage years. When Grandma finally relented and went to bed in what felt like 9 hours, the boys left. "I know you had boys up there," she said to us the next morning. "I know you were smoking that weed." "No, we didn't," I said. "Aunt Joanne kept saying, 'And I know you took my wine coolers.'" "No, we didn't," I said. "Did Grandma take them?" offered Kenyatta. "You know," I said, "other people come over here." It's one of my greatest shames that some of my last memories of my grandmother when she was cognizant were just bald-faced lies. In a short while, she would have dementia and not know who I was. But I have to tell you, I would have done anything for Kevin Marshall. My parents let me go back to Omaha that Christmas, and the only reason I went was to have a chance to see Kevin Marshall and get a real kiss. And I got it. Kevin Marshall tongue-kissed me on the corner of 49th and Fort, right by the bus stop. "I'm pretty," I thought. Kevin Marshall, this light-skinned boy with green eyes who is not supposed to find me attractive, found me pretty enough to kiss. On the level playing field of Omaha, a guy like Kevin was a huge get, having his pick of the pecking order of skin color that is in place in black and brown communities across the world. And he had picked a chocolate girl like me. Then I thought, maybe black boys like me. The next summer, when I was 15, I eased back into my blackness even more quickly. But North Omaha had changed more, too. It was no longer the Disney version of gang culture. It was real. The buzz in the air now seemed more scary than exhilarating. Boys would pick Kenyatta and me up to go for a ride, and we'd end up going over the bridge to Council Bluffs because they needed to pick up some money or deliver a package. It continually felt like the beginning of a bad movie. These were not bad people. These were regular kids who got swept up in the frenzy of having to be in a gang and do gang shit to impress each other. Drive-by shootings started happening, and kids began to get killed. Something very bad was coming. My cousin was dating this guy named Ryan. He and his friend Lucky were always around. Lucky always had cornrows that never appeared freshly braided. They drove vintage El Caminos, restored status symbols they called old schools. You saw these cars, lovingly and expensively restored by masters, and knew these guys had money. One night, Ryan did a drive-by, shooting someone in the neck and paralyzing him. We saw a police sketch on the news, and my grandma said, "Doesn't that look like your friend Ryan?" "Nope," said Kenyatta. "No way," I said, thinking. "Yep, that's Ryan." He came to the door later that night after Grandma went to sleep. Kenyatta let him in quickly, and we sat on the steps leading upstairs. Ryan had the gun, and he placed it on the ground by his feet. We all stared at it. "Can I hold it?" Kenyatta asked. He picked it up by the handle, and she held it, aiming away from us. She looked at it with a mixture of admiration and fear. This gun had been fired, and it had paralyzed someone. The whole town was looking for Ryan, and here he was.
Can I?
I asked.
Kenyatta handed it to me, and I held it like you would a caterpillar, with my fingers splayed out, not to touch anything. It was so heavy.
I thought, that's why he accidentally shot that kid. It's probably just too big a gun for him to aim.
Can I stay here? Asked Ryan. It hadn't occurred to me he would ask that, but it obviously had to Kenyatta, who nodded quickly.
We'll put you in the basement, she said. Grandma won't know.
And we did.
For 3 weeks, we brought him food. Peanut butter sandwiches we made covertly, leftovers from dinner, beer when we had it. We kept him company, talking about what was going on in the neighborhood. I watched some detective show where they accused this woman of harboring a fugitive. I felt like I had a secret. I was protecting a good guy who made a mistake.
Police knew it was Ryan who had done the shooting, and it became clear to him that this hideout plan wouldn't last. He turned himself in. He went to prison. Lucky was killed the following summer, leading everyone to think they were the first one to say, guess he wasn't so lucky. Another friend got shot and had to wear a colostomy bag for the rest of his life. Kevin joined a gang, then his best friend Dennis died. A girl I knew stabbed a jitney driver rather than pay him $5. He lived. He'd known her since she was a baby and was able to tell police exactly where she lived, who her grandfather was, hell, who her great-grandmother was. Another boy that I thought was so cute shot up a Bronco Burgers. The mom of one of our friends decided she had to get her son out of Omaha. She sent him to Denver, and he got mixed up with gangs there. He got killed, too. None of these people changed. The environment around them did. They were all good people who made choices that ended up having insane consequences. But their hearts never changed. They were playing roles assigned to them, the same way I did in Pleasanton. When I would go back to Pleasanton at the end of those Nebraska summers, I didn't share any of those stories. The kids I went to school with didn't deserve to hear them. They were mine. And I knew I could never convince my friends of the innate goodness of Kenyatta, Kevin, and Lucky anyway. Of Ryan, even. So I would simply become the invisible black girl again. I checked my language, the cadence of my walk, and the confidence of just being in my skin. The older I got, the more resentful I became of these reentry periods. People in California noticed my attitude was different. I was quicker to anger at slights. I wouldn't play buckwheat. I especially struggled back home after the summer of hiding Ryan. I don't know if my older sister Kelly noticed or if I just got lucky, but she took me under her wing. By then she was in college, starting out at USC before transferring to San Jose State. Immediately at USC, she found a very cool group of black friends. I was so jealous. When she got away from the house, she stopped having to be my mother's sister. She was just Kelly, and our relationship changed for the better. When I was 15, she took me to a black frat party at San Jose State. It was like she gave me the keys to this kingdom of cool black people who valued education and fun. They were just worldly and cool and dope and sexy. In the way that Omaha gave me an outlet for my Pleasanton frustration, my sister's world of college became a new outlet. I looked around at these students and saw black excellence. I met an Alpha Phi Alpha brother named Daryl who talked to me for a long time that night. He even gave me his number. I gave him a fake number in return because I had lied about my age, and this was a man. But I held on to that piece of paper for years. That night made me see the either-or schism I was trapped in. Between Pleasanton and Omaha, I was caught in a dual consciousness. Who I had to be when I was around my own people,
and who I had to be in high school. Now it's easy to see how caught I was in that back-and-forth mental chess match of trying to be okay in both worlds. Two warring ideals in one dark body, as Du Bois wrote. The dark body of a young girl. Each was me, but the constant code-switching, changing my language, demeanor, and identity expression to fit in, left me exhausted. You were fly, dope, and amazing from birth, I would tell that girl now. From the second you took your first breath, you were worthwhile and valid. And I'm sorry you had to wait so long to learn that for yourself. Chapter 2, Sex Miseducation. In the fifth grade, the girls were all ushered into the school multipurpose room, where it was explained to us that we could get pregnant at any moment. Well, at least our period would strike any minute, which meant we could hypothetically conceive a child. The problem is, Miss Brackett forgot to include the part about how we would get pregnant. She just left it at, it could just happen. No one was brave enough to ask questions, and if you don't know how you get pregnant, just that it might happen at any moment, it's a little scary. I would lie awake at night in my room, clutching my bed-in-a-bag twin sheets to my chin and wondering what could happen to impregnate me. If you were raised Catholic like I was, you already know from Sunday school that nothing really has to happen. You could go to sleep and wake up carrying baby Jesus. I've seen countless paintings of the Annunciation where Mary accepts the news that she is pregnant. But my favorite is Dante Gabriel Rossetti's at the Tate Britain in London. Mary is in bed giving the angel Gabriel a bleary-eyed look of, are you fucking kidding me right now? That's how we felt. Are you kidding me with this? At any moment you could become a mom stuff? We lived in a primarily Catholic and Mormon town, so our moms definitely weren't chatting among themselves about periods. When any of my friends' moms talked to them, it was to simply hand them some pads. I certainly wasn't going to talk to my older sister about it, and because I could barely decode Tampax commercials, I looked for information in books. Naturally, my friends and I turned to Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, Judy Blume's classic 1970 menstruation how-to disguised as a pre-adolescent narrative. Among us 10 and 11-year-olds, the book became required reading, and we ferreted out dog-eared copies from the local library, big sisters, and a few progressive mothers. Some girls, like me, just skipped to the blood pages. They'd hand me a copy, and I'd fan through the pages to the good parts. Then I'd pass the wisdom on to the next girl. Here, I'd say, pointing. Then here. We needed answers because it was all so scary. The idea of bleeding randomly and accepting it as natural seemed completely unnatural. After all, when you skinned your knee, you ran for a Band-Aid. Where's the Bactine? I have to cover this. But when it came to our periods, we were supposed to be celebratory? Like our moms would suddenly initiate us into their blood cult? This was a horror movie set in the leafy surroundings of Pleasanton Middle School. It came from Melody first. In fifth grade, during homeroom. She bled right through her pants. She looked down in shock, the blood slowly blossoming in the crotch in the back of her pants, and Lucas, the boy who called me a nigger in the second grade, saw it first and reliably pounced. "Melody is having her period," he yelled out, disgusted and delighted. "Let's jump her!" He and a few of his lackeys hooted with laughter while the rest of us looked on in horror and panic. Now an initiate into the blood cult of adult women, Melody, of course, could get pregnant at any moment. Where was the teacher? Don't ask. Faculty lounge, smoke break. After a few excruciating moments, Melody unfroze and ran screaming. No one followed her. That included me. I felt ashamed. I was her friend, but for much of the school year, it was like being friends with a leper. Nobody else got her period for the longest time, but soon enough, all of the girls in fifth grade became familiar with Melody's month-to-month schedule, and when she was absent, we spoke gravely of her condition, dramatically shushing each other when a boy came within hearing range. By seventh grade, Melody was no longer alone in her period drama, as all of us were getting picked off like flies. One of our friends would stay home from school or race to the nurse's office, and then we would know. It came for her. No one I knew was excited about it. You looked forward to it the way you look forward to food poisoning. I knew that at any moment it would be my turn to stand up and everyone would point in my direction. I remember we all wore dark colors in case it happened. I began carrying my jean jacket with me at all times, ready for the big moment. I pinned concert buttons all over it of the top 40 stuff I loved. Stray Cats, Def Leppard, New Edition, Billy Joel, and tied it around my waist to conceal the inevitable evidence when the time came. We asked each other so many questions because unless we'd been struck, none of us had answers. Like, what happens? You put this pad on and then what? You're just bleeding and sitting in it? I finally became a woman in a bathroom stall at Macy's halfway through seventh grade. I was at Stone Ridge Mall with a few friends. I felt a little dampness down below, started silently panicking and screaming, and then whispered to my friends, "Oh my God, I think it's happening." We speed walked to the restroom, and my friend Becky, always prepared, handed me a pad. I went into the stall a girl and came out an adult. When I got home, I tried to pretend as if nothing had happened. I balled up my bloody underwear and jeans and stuffed them deep in the closet of the bathroom I shared with my older sister, Kelly. I felt cramped and sore, but I just didn't want to have the mortifying talk with anyone. I don't know why I didn't throw the clothes away. I guess it felt wasteful. Kid logic is just dumb. Weeks later, my mom found them while cleaning the house. "I found your," she paused, "soiled underwear." Ugh. To this day, the word soiled still makes me cringe. She handed me some pads, offering no instructions, no sitting on the couch and patting the cushion next to her, and that was that. But I kept worrying about my next period, and I was terrified of being humiliated at school. Every month was a guessing game. When will it happen? Will everyone find out? Will guys try to jump me and make me pregnant? At first, I didn't know how to use the pads, and for a full year, I continually had accidents because my pads were riding high. Not only did I not know how pads worked, I didn't understand how my vagina worked either. And that's because, dear reader, I thought my clitoris was my vagina. I started masturbating early, age 5 or 6. So I knew where the fun was. I knew where my clitoris was. My vagina, not so much. I'd live my life thinking, of course sex is painful, because it's where you pee from. And of course childbirth is painful, because you pee out a baby. Even though I'd seen a number of anatomy diagrams, I knew where I masturbated, so I assumed that was my vagina. I only discovered my vagina in the eighth grade after a year of accidents. My girlfriend, Danielle, Big D, and I were swimming at a local sports complex called AVAC, short for Amador Valley Athletic Club. And of course, I got my period. In the water, I noticed a wispy trail of blood. It was coming from me. It was especially mortifying because AVAC was as fancy as a country club with the best of everything. I frantically climbed out of the pool with Big D following and locked myself in a bathroom. She talked to me through the door. "Nick, it's okay," Big D said, concern in her voice but cool as ever. She had a bookie dad and was never prudish like most of the other girls I knew then. "I have to go home," I said frantically. "Oh, just put in a tampon," said Big D. "I'm not a whore," I shrieked. "We just assumed tampons made you break your hymen, so if you use them instead of pads, you are no longer a virgin. And at that stage, if you weren't a virgin in Pleasanton, you were considered a whore." "What?" said Big D. The record scratched. "I've never used one," I whispered. "Open the door," she said, and I did, but just a crack. She passed me a plastic wrap cylinder, and I took it from her, grateful. "Now lay on the floor," I heard her voice say, coaching me through it. "Put your knees up and just slowly put it in."